Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. Comments can be addressed to me at rhall@oregonstate.edu. Today, my guest is Jean Nelson. She's the program manager for adult mental health services for Bend County. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
We always like to talk a little bit about the guest's background. And
I actually used to be a drug user many years ago. And that's how I got interested, you know, in my process of getting clean. I decided that I could actually use this kind of negative knowledge to actually do good for the world, so to speak. So I went back to school to become a drug and alcohol counselor. I was a single parent with three little kids. It was pretty tough. So I became an intern. In California, this was a pretty long time ago, they basically said to me, "Do you think you can do this counseling work?" And I thought, well, I just went through treatment, so I guess I can give treatment. And they ushered me into the room, and I became a treatment provider. You know, I was an intern and going to a community college. And so I began to work as a drug and alcohol counselor. And then,
were you at that time working with a county health program?
I was working with a nonprofit, Episcopal Community Services. It's in San Diego. I got my bachelor's degree in social work. And so while I was going to school, I worked as a drug and alcohol counselor. Got my master's degree, did various kinds of internships at a lot of different sites, and then I finally got my license in clinical social work.
I had 2 years as a postdoc in Connecticut at the Alcohol Research Center. We worked with patients. At that time, actually, it was the only alcohol research center. There were 9 of them funded at that time by the federal government. It was the only one, believe it or not, that worked with human patients.
Oh, my goodness.
They were totally experimental. Well, you have a long title in Bend County, and you wear a number of different hats as the program manager for adult mental health services. Tell me a little about how the drug and alcohol treatment and the whole program works today.
There's been a substance abuse program that was part of Bend County for a long time. So at New Beginnings, we have a collaboration with the court. So that's the Drug Treatment Court Program.
So that is mandated?
That's an interesting question because people use that word mandated a lot. Some people are sentenced to drug treatment court, but the number is pretty small. Mostly at whatever point, so they've had a legal circumstance happens, and at some point they're in court, and basically they're given the choice, do you want to join drug treatment court or don't you? Once they're in, it becomes a compliance program. You have to follow the rules. You don't get to just say, okay, I'm done, I want to be done. Once you're in, you've made a choice that, that you have to comply. Yeah.
And that could be perhaps a DUII?
Not so much in this county. Sometimes from DUIIs, most people who report to us have methamphetamine problems or marijuana. Often it is that it can be possession or not too often under the influence, but sometimes there's an associated crime with it. Maybe it was breaking into somebody's car, or identity theft is a very common one. So often there's an associated crime that it can clearly be tied to drug use or alcohol use. There are other entities in town, Emergence, where their kind of bread and butter is doing DUII.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so we don't really want to compete with them.
Oh, so those are private entities, and yours is the county services.
Yeah, we're the county. Okay. So I've tried to be careful because it's my belief that it's good to have a robust recovery community. So there's drug treatment court, and then there's community corrections program. So those referrals, that's actually a kind of legal program also. I guess in terms of accountability, drug treatment court is the most difficult. It's usually at least a year. Oftentimes people are in the program for 18 months. It's a very complex program. There's involvement from the court, there's involvement from treatment and probation and parole, and there's lots and lots of accountability.
Mm-hmm. And by that, you mean that they have to account to many different entities.
That's right. Right. Everybody's kind of got their finger on them.
Right. Yeah.
So probation and parole is typically somebody's done some sort of a crime, and this might be DUI or, again, possession or any of the other kinds of crimes associated with that. And usually it's been determined that they can meet with their probation officer and successfully complete their probation and be on their way. And then at assessment time, when the probation officer meets with that individual, they determine that they think somebody would benefit from a drug and alcohol program. So we serve those folks, too. Mm-hmm. There is also just a standard outpatient program. So if you're having a problem and you're in the community and you want to get clean and sober, you can just walk in the door and ask us for services.
And you would walk in the door at New Beginnings. So all of the drug and alcohol services are focused right there.
Right.
And the mental health, some of them, though, are elsewhere. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
they're all over at the health department.
Oh, okay. Great.
Actually, it's a little more complex than that, but that's kind of the simple way to think of it. Yeah, because there's actually some mental health services going on over at New Beginnings.
Yes.
In that we serve people with co-occurring disorders. So they may have a mental illness and an addiction. So then we also work with child welfare, and we work with individuals who are in the DHS self-sufficiency program.
DHS, that would be Department of Health Services.
Yeah,
in that.
That's really the state.
Wow, this is a lot.
There's a lot of programs in there, yeah.
Yeah, and so first a person may be referred to you by one of these, and then you talk to the client and figure out where they fit best. And do you call them clients?
Goes back and forth. A lot of times I call them participants. I like that because they are. They're participating. I guess the current movement is to use the word consumer, and a lot of folks like that word. I personally
don't like it.
I wouldn't like it if I were that. It feels like you're using something up.
Yeah.
Client's kind of the old-fashioned word. I think a lot of people use that. I think it's kind of all over the place.
Client and participant.
The state tells us that we need to use the word individual. People are individuals, so that's kind of a lot of
covers a lot of ground.
And it's a lot of syllables too. The individual.
Oh my goodness!
So here's how they're walking in the door. So Drug Treatment Court does its own little process. They will identify people who are in the adjudication process. Maybe they're in court, so they kind of keep their eye open for people who fit the criteria that would be good people for Drug Treatment Court. Then the staffing team, which is composed of the judge, probation, treatment, they all identify a person and say, well, maybe this person. At that point, they come over to New Beginnings and we conduct a screen to see if they meet criteria, if they actually need the services. So that's how that happens. Probation and parole, they will administer a screen, and they have a number of them, the LSCMI, level of service and case management. They have some screening tools.
Don't you just love those acronyms?
We got a million of them, too.
I bet.
It's acronyms. It's just dreadful. So anyway, they have their way of screening them. You know, child welfare has a screen, the self-sufficiency program. And then when the individual is actually into our agency, we do a number of screens also.
Mm. And by screens, now, are these like questionnaires or interviews?
Basically, basically, yeah. So we have some criminality screens to see what kind of services are going to benefit from trauma screens.
Oh.
We do an actual ASAM assessment, which is American Society of Addiction Medicine, the addictions assessment. So then we place the person in the specific groups that are going to benefit them.
So
we have education groups. We have groups that are basically a, kind of a combination focus so that they get treated for their criminality and their addiction issues.
Mm-hmm.
We have groups that treat people for addiction and trauma. So basically, after we assess them, then we kind of look at what's going to serve them the best. And we have groups in the morning, in the afternoon, in the late afternoon, in the evening. The cognitive errors groups.
Do you sort them by age at all or not?
We sort them by the way that they present. When we do an assessment with them, we basically determine what their need is based on their evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have level one, which is your first attempt at treatment.
Okay.
And then we have level two. So that's going to be intensive outpatient. And it can be from 9 to 20 hours a week.
Wow.
So we have groups all throughout the day. And we have an alcohol track. We have a track that focuses on methamphetamine. Like I said, we have the sort of criminality track. So you can just kind of look at the various things that compose this person's presentation and plug in the different kinds of treatment venues. And then there's urine screening, and, you know, a lot of people come to us and they need housing, and so there's case management. There's an Oxford House and Agency that was developed. It's sort of a 12-step basis. So some folks who are in recovery and very much involved with the 12-step model put their brains together and come up with a sober living opportunity, and they call it Oxford House. Based on the model called the Oxford model, it's very egalitarian. Everybody has a role. One person is the person who collects the money. Another person is the one who makes sure everybody does their chores. And they vote people in and they vote people out.
How long might they stay?
You know, as long as they want to. And then Drug Treatment Court, they actually have a grant that they applied for with the Bureau of Justice, and they opened up their own housing facility. A lot of alcohol and drug counseling is not just the information that people are getting, but it's also helping them get the resources that they need. Food stamps and unemployment and jobs. And
very, very diverse.
Yeah.
What issues do you think are really big right now? Now, methamphetamine, of course, has been a problem in Oregon for a decade or two.
While it is true that methamphetamine is still a big concern, the abuse of painkillers is really become a salient issue. We have a lot of people coming in who have either pain issues and they're taking medication for that and they become addicted. Or else they're just abusing, you know, pharmacological medications. I'm not sure why, but anyway, that's kind of all the rage right now.
For heaven's sakes.
And the kids are doing it because they find it in their parents' medicine cabinets. And the pendulum just sort of swings back and forth. First it's stimulants, then it's depressants. And that one's particularly hard because it's very hard to say to somebody who's in pain, don't take that medication.
Right.
And there's a lot of research that shows for some people, they take the medication and then their brain just isn't working. I can't be clear about exactly what happens, but sometimes we feel like we're in pain when we're really not. It's a misreading of the message in our brain. And then, of course, there's that element of withdrawal. When you stop taking the medication, you hurt. And so a misinterpretation of that kind of pain might cause a person to think they're in pain and they need the medication, when in actuality, they're in the addiction process.
Yeah. I just this summer broke my patella bike accident. It was split in two. It's not supposed to be in two parts. So there was surgery. I found that the pain medication that was offered me, I really didn't like it. I took it one day. It was better without it, believe me. And for me, it upset my digestive tract, and I didn't feel comfortable. I was always offered more. They offer it and anticipate you're going to want it, and it would be very tempting.
Addiction is really complex. Dependency is really complex. I'm kind of a jokester.
Good. So I think that may make you survive in this field because you want a good joke from time to time.
And I just know it's just part of my personality. But so my comment is always that nobody wants to get clean because they're having a great time. Nobody comes in and says, I'm having so much fun. I think I'll stop doing this. No one does that. So it's always pain. And in some respects, pain is the basis of addiction anyway.
Oh.
You know, if you think about it, I mean, we all know somebody who we see their kid having a hard time, and pretty soon you see that addictive behavior happen. It's associated with ill feelings, with discomfort. It's psychological discomfort. It can be physical discomfort. It's family problems. It's poverty. It's just a whole range of things. And a lot of time, pain is one of the things that, and psychological pain can manifest as physical pain.
Sure.
So it's really hard to ferret out exactly what's going on. And certainly those kinds of drugs where it didn't feel good to you. And frankly, I broke my wrist last year and they gave me meds too. And I didn't take them either because it was like, oh, I don't like them.
Yeah. Right.
But for some people, it's the ticket.
Yes.
They take that and they say, boy, I don't only not hurt now. I don't hurt at all. I feel better. And so hurt becomes a really voluminous word. It has a lot of meaning. You can hurt lots of places. And when this makes the hurting stop,
it's very attractive.
It's very attractive.
Yeah, until some of the other things happen that, that happen over time.
That's
and
right.
that's the, what brings the person the secular knocking on
it,
your door,
right.
I suppose. Yeah. At New Beginnings, do you do any one-to-one counseling?
Or is it always? There's always one-to-one counseling and group counseling. We do urine screening. So just to keep everybody honest and give them the support they need. So, yeah, there's one-on-one counseling, too.
And the urine screening is when they make a visit in the regular program, they do that initially?
Or, Well, throughout. It's periodic, you know. Of course, you want to believe somebody if they say, I'm not using, but the best way is just this objective measure.
Empirical
so that's
data.
That's right. And, you know, I think some of the clients at first, or consumers, I guess, at first consider it punitive. Why do you have to do this? But my experience has always been over time, they realize that it's support.
It is support.
You've got all the proof. I am who I said I am, and I'm doing what I said I'm doing. And what causes a lot of angst at first, though, because they know they have this process coming. And another one of my jokes is an old-time AA joke. So they talk about denial. It's don't even know I am lying, you know? And that's really where people are at. It's they don't feel like they're lying. They don't mean to be lying. It's not about that. They're just trying to protect themselves and keep their lives moving in the direction that they think is a good way to move.
When I was at the Connecticut Health Center, we had a screening tool that some of us used called the Diagnostic Interview Schedule. We were interviewing a control group, which was dental patients, and they received a little remuneration for their time to have a control group, age and sex matched for the patients who were in the alcohol treatment center. And people would walk in and look just fine.
Just fine.
And you go through this. It's a very clever and lengthy process of an hour and a half or 2 hours. And wow, you think, oh my goodness, how is this individual even walking around?
Yeah.
That's helped me in a way in thinking about people and looking at them that you can't tell.
You can't tell.
You have to always keep in mind if someone behaves rudely or whatever, that something might be going on.
You know, when I was in treatment, one of the things that helped me feel better all those years ago was when my counselor said to me, the first thing that happens is a lot of shame. You realize all the lying and the bad behavior that you've done, and depending upon what your, you know, to your parents or to your children or to your friends. And one of the things that this provider said was, you know what, you were doing the best you could. And that, I think, for a lot of folks who are trying to get clean, that's one of the things that helps them is to be able to look back on their life and say, I didn't set out in my life to be an addict, to be an alcoholic, to destroy my credit, to hurt my children, to hurt my parents, to hurt my husband or my wife. I didn't set out to do that. I just set out to have my life and do the best I could. And somewhere along the line, the pain that I was experiencing sort of reduced my choices so that I began to make worse and worse and worse choices. And at some point, you find yourself in the middle of this ugly bubble, so to speak, with really, really, really limited choices. And at that point, it's just self-preservation. And so you just continue to make those choices. They're not good choices. We know women get into prostitution, people get into burglary and all kinds of stuff, but I personally don't think that people choose to be bad.
Right.
They just have limited their choices so much, and then they don't know how to get out of it.
Very nice analysis.
People who seek treatment are so courageous because they have surrounded themselves with things that are familiar, things that will support their continued use. And in order to get clean, they have to push away everything. There's another old AA saying, the only thing you have to change to get clean and sober is everything. And it's hard.
It is hard,
It's very hard.
It's important, I suppose, as a counselor that you can have that relationship with somebody that you can tell them that and smile about it because because they're there.
That's right. They are there.
Yeah, they walked in the door, and that's how New Beginnings applies.
That's right.
Because you actually try to have a new beginning and change a whole lot of things.
people don't always come in and get it the first time. Right. And you can't drag them by the nose and make them get there. You have to keep saying, basically, well, how's that working for you?
Right.
You're going to jail again. How's that working for you?
Yeah, right.
And it's hard to stand back and watch them make those choices and just continue to invite them to make better decisions. Mm-hmm. You sit there and say, you can't, no, and just sweat. They don't listen to you. You can't be confrontive in treatment. You have to invite people into the process. And so
be supportive along the way.
Yeah. And it can be hard to watch somebody make bad choices repeatedly and you get wrapped up with them. If you care about people at all and you're in this field, it can lead to burnout.
It can, yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing I remember from the Connecticut program was trying to evaluate which programs work best by following people who've graduated from the program and seeing what happens to them a year later, 2 years, 5 years. And that's very difficult because they move around a lot, of course. But also, it became clear that for some people, it was maybe something that they did in treatment 2 treatments ago that actually caught up with them and made them do better maybe the 5th time or the 4th time.
That's right.
In other words, the evaluation on a strictly statistical basis, it's unfortunate if it's the only thing people pay attention to.
I used to tell myself, sometimes you plant the seed, and sometimes you get to harvest.
Oh, very good.
You always have to remember that. You know, even statistically, you know, most people do get clean. Most of them do. Mm-hmm. They may not get it this time. 25% of the people get it the first time, or maybe it's 30.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then another 30% or so, they have to go in and out of treatment a couple of times. The thing is, for a lot of people, their pain tolerance gets pretty high. You'll hear folks say, I'm not homeless, I'm camping. Or I don't mind not having a car. Because like I said, if you believe in my philosophy, and that is that, or my construct, that they come to you in pain anyway. They have a really high tolerance for pain. So their life can get pretty torn apart before it actually gets through and hurts anymore. And they say, okay, all right, now you have my attention. Which is why the criminal justice programs, for some people, are good. Because they sort of put the hurt on before you have to lose everything, you know?
Yeah.
You get caught by the criminal justice system, it brings you in before you've completely destroyed your marriage, completely made your kids hate you, before you've completely ruined your credit. There's a lot of discussion about whether courts and police should be involved in treatment, but sometimes whatever works. There's a lot of people who think drug and alcohol treatment doesn't work, and that goes back a long ways in that drug and alcohol treatment has changed over time and become better. And one of the ways that it's become better is that people like you actually did research, asked those questions, what are you doing now, what did you do along the way, and how's it working, and came up with this concept of evidence-based practices. We utilize those evidence-based practices, and the state has required that you use a certain amount of evidence-based practices in your treatments. It's been a developing field for a long time.
Right.
Started out with Synanon. It's just this old-fashioned yell at people until they get clean. You're a piece of trash, blah, blah, that kind of stuff. So those are very, very early days of treatment in the 50s. Before that, it was, you know, the sanitariums where they'd send somebody away and let them dry out and talk to them about their ego and then send them back out and they'd go drink again. So it's been a developing field over the last 100 years or so. So in treatment, we talk about the idea of abstinence versus recovery. You can stop drinking or using and still be miserable. If you are in recovery, then you're in an active process of pursuing coping skills that are going to help you meet your needs in a positive way. So people do that. They get into treatment and then they stop using for X amount of time. And they walk out the door and they use again. So then you know they were abstinent during that period of time, but they didn't seek recovery. And they didn't get into the process. So
this reminds me of The Bear Who Could Take It or Leave It Alone. And anyway, it's...
Great title.
Yeah. It's about this bear. Well, he's a person, but a person bear who gets into drinking after work. And he goes to the bar. And then when he comes home, he throws the furniture around, makes a mess, and frightens the children. After some time, he decides to get sober. And he does. But then he gets into other behaviors, talking, lecturing, kind of feeling self-important, I guess. And he stays out late at night, and he throws the chairs around and frightens the children. So that's one of Thurber's fables.
He was a dry drunk. And so those are some of the challenges people face. They have only, they have a really limited set of tools in their toolbox to meet their needs, to help them calm down, to help them not be angry, to help them be social, to help them think.
Yeah.
And basically over here, their toolbox has got drugs, alcohol, whatever. Over here, this toolbox is empty.
Right.
So we try to help them fill up that toolbox. But meanwhile, their brain is affected by the substances they've been using. They have what's commonly called the wreckage of the past. So maybe they have tickets. Maybe they have no place to live. Maybe they have all these things going on. So they're trying to learn these positive things. They have all this stuff really just dragging on them. It's very hard.
It's really hard
to get clean.
And more often than this exaggerated story of the bear, you know, tossing the house around, is the individual who doesn't relate to somebody.
Yeah.
I suspect that would be a more common dry drunk. We've covered a lot of topics. This has been just great fun. I particularly enjoy laughing with you.
I'm glad. I like laughing too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jean Nelson, Program Manager for Adult Services in Mental Health in Benton County. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording in Corvallis, Oregon. Theme music was composed by Lori Childers and played by Lori Childers in Kent White.